the guillotine continues to slice through the public service.
It almost leaves me speechless, actually.
1,000 jobs gone in a single day at Oranga Tamariki and the Ministry of Education.
As I've said before, you know, I want more medical doctors, not spin doctors.
But in a case of do as I say, not as I do, News Hub revealed the tribe of spin doctors the Prime Minister has working on his social media.
I don't know, I couldn't tell you, but it's not his.
Well, you be the judge. It's seven. Seven staff working on his TikTok.
Well, look, I have to be honest, I question some of the things I do, but look, I'm out there and I'm giving it a go, and some stuff will work and some stuff won't, but isn't it fantastic that I'm doing that? It's brilliant.
Perhaps why he carved out time to have noodles with a Singaporean influencer.
Everybody, I am having breakfast today with the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Can I just say, I think you have the best job in the world.
Oh, I really do.
It's brilliant News Hub stories like that that will hopefully be preserved in the massive deal done between Warner Brothers Discovery and Stuff.
Look, as a journalist myself, more news, more journalists is a good thing for everybody, not just for the industry, but for our society.
Stuff will take over production of 3-6 o'clock news, bringing over some staff from News Hub.
Look, if a part of the company can be saved, if we can still tell fantastic stories, if we can still hold people to account, I think it's a beautiful thing.
That was News Hub's Amanda Gillies. Here's the spin-off's Duncan Grieve.
Creating TV-first journalism is really different to creating kind of print or written journalism. And so, you know, I think that challenge potentially has been underestimated.
Huge news too for police this week. They have overwhelmingly voted against the government's latest pay offer.
Yeah, it's disappointing for us, given I think we felt we put our best foot forward and took very seriously the need to up the offer, which we did well.
And finally, we'll leave you with the zinger of the week.
I'm going to send him a big bill at the end of every year, charging all the costs that we're doing for free.
No, not Brian Tamaki having a cry about the Prime Minister's possible church and charities tax review, but this retort from the Finance Minister.
Doesn't sound very Christian.
Kia ora Aotearoa, I'm Tova O'Brien. Welcome to the pod. Before, during and after last year's election campaign, pretty much all parties appealed to the so-called squeezed middle, the everyday Kiwis doing it tough. But 6 months on, the cost of living crisis continues to bite. Almost all of us are affected, but it's a large chunk of that squeezed middle we're focusing on for this show, specifically the people grappling with monthly mortgage bills. A lot of people might think, lucky you, you've got a mortgage and a house in the first place, and maybe they're right, but that doesn't change the fact that mortgage rates have more than doubled over the last 2 years, and that can mean the difference between just making it and really struggling. In August 2021, the average one-year fixed rate was 2.6%. Now that same rate sits at around 7.3%. 2.6 to 7.3, and those spikes have seen some home loan repayments double. Amid pain at the petrol pump, rising council rates, growing grocery prices, and all the rest, some are being forced into tough, in some cases life-changing, decisions. The latest Centrix report shows the number of people getting behind on their mortgage payments is at the highest level since January 2020, with 22,600 mortgage accounts past due. That's an increase of 800 in a single month. The government's promised help for the squeezed middle in its first budget, locked and looming on May 30th. We'll hear from Finance Minister Nicola Willis later as we explore the issue from every angle. In this pod, the people, the homeowners making those tough decisions, a money advisor, and then, because all roads lead back to banks, an extended interview with the chief executive of a major bank. And then we'll have a breakout shortcast, extra for experts, where we are and how we got here, drilling into the state of the property market and impact of recent political decisions with a property economist, and exploring the role of the Reserve Bank with a former Reserve Bank governor. The good, the bad, and the ugly, we'll hear it all on this week's pod, Home Discomforts, Living on the Edge. We'll start with the most important people in the stories, those affected daily by mortgage misery. First, Chantal Mitchell, with her husband Joseph and their three children. They moved cities just this week to make ends meet. Chantal, welcome to the pod. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you tell us a bit more about your situation? You were in Stokes Valley in Wellington, but you had to sell up. Why and where have you gone? Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so basically our mortgage repayments had become just unmanageable. We had four mortgage loans and we'd been in our house for 10 years and some of those were interest only and they were on about 2.5%. And then slowly they started renewing about May last year. A couple of them renewed, that got a bit harder. And then December last year we had the other two renew and they went on to almost over 7%. It just became so unmanageable that we were already living paycheck to paycheck. It was hard enough. We had no other debt either, so there was not really anything we could cut further. We went to budgeters to see if there was anything, and they basically said the same thing, which was play with money in your grocery bill, but our mortgage had increased so much that it was costing more than my grocery bill, so it was impossible. So we started looking up north because it was cheaper, and the only logical place to go would be Whanganui because my husband has family there. So the stability of for our kids moving from my family to his family just made sense. So that's what we did.
And so you've had to leave all of your friends, your kids as well. How old are your kids? Because this must have been a huge wrench for all of you.
Yeah, so our kids are 2, 4, and 6. And yeah, we've obviously left family and friends in Wellington. Yeah, it has been pretty hard, but we're still obviously getting used to it because we've only just moved here, but at least we know Whanganui, so it's familiar. But we've also moved to a smaller house, so it's going to be a bit tricky. Yeah.
And do you mind, Chantelle, talking about how your health has been impacting on your finances as well?
Yeah, so I have a brain tumour, so
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. I've had to continue keeping my health insurance, for instance, because I have a lot of specialist appointments. I've got regular MRIs. I've had surgery just May last year, but they couldn't get it all. So I'm sort of taking supplements and things like that, and they can be quite costly. So that's sort of something we can't really compromise on, unfortunately. Yeah, it's just an extra expense.
Totally. And I don't imagine those health insurance premiums are going down.
No. If anything, they're going up. And our house insurance went up $100 in December as well, which didn't help the situation. So insurances are cheaper here, rates are cheaper here. So have they been quite helpful?
Mm. Well, that's good. And I wonder as well, is there anything that could have made things easier for you? Anything that the powers that be, the politicians or the banks or whatever, could have done to support you better?
The only thing we really looked into was getting some of our KiwiSaver out. We were told that if we tried to get it for financial hardship that it could affect our credit rating, which could be an issue, I guess, with mortgages. So we didn't really want to do that. But we were also told by my KiwiSaver provider at the time that it was going to be almost impossible to get it out because we weren't considered to be in hardship because we didn't have credit cards or unpaid bills and debt aside from our mortgage. Fortunately for us, we had an alternative where I could get it out because of the brain tumour, so you can get it out for a serious illness like that. So that has helped us because moving house is not cheap either, and we had to pay literally thousands of dollars to get moving to Whanganui. If we didn't do that, we would have been very stuck. Mm. And so I think, you know, being able to tap into even, you know, $5,000 with a KiwiSaver would have been a big help. That may have even got us through a few extra months of paying our mortgage, and maybe we could have stayed in our house, which would have been great because it was the first house we bought, and brought all our babies home there from the hospital, and we didn't really want to sell, you know. It would have been helpful, but, you know, it is what it is, and we just have to make the best of what we have now. So
It seems perverse that you can't access your own money in times where you desperately need it because you're not, you know, you're not up to your eyeballs in debt with credit cards and things. That seems really perverse to me. Chantelle, I wish you all the very best in your new city and your new home, and I'm so grateful that you made time to speak with us. Thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you.
That's the perspective of a family living in their own home, forced to move to another. What about homeowners with rental property? Landlords don't always get positive headlines, but our next guest has fought a years-long battle to do the right thing by his tenant, only to now reluctantly admit defeat. Even with changes to interest deductibility, which give landlords a tax break on interest paid on rentals, he's looking to sell his investment property in the Wellington region. Malcolm, welcome to the pod. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you've tried hard to keep the weekly rent down. How much has it gone up by for your tenants?
Well, we've had these tenants in our property for the last, coming up 5 years, and we have only raised the rent $30,
wow.
About $20 or $30. So they're currently paying in our rental property about $420 a week.
Right. And what kind of property is that? How many bedrooms? And
It's a three-bedroom, one bathroom, separate toilet, lounge, 90-square-metre house. On its own little block, about 560 square metres, give or take. And, it's just up there in Upper Hutt.
Yeah, well, that's a good deal, right? And you've tried to keep the rent down. Why? Why was that important to you?
We think it's the right thing to do. It's the human thing to do. Times are tough, and it's too much for people to expect to be, charged out of existence purely because of the interest rates are going up. Now, we're in a fortunate position. We were able to keep it down. We've been working hard. I was over in Australia for the last 15 years, and, we've poured money into the house. We've put a new kitchen in there. It cost us about $35,000. We, over the course of these years, going by the current rate markets, we've probably lost maybe $30,000 that we could have paid off on the mortgage. Mm. But what does that mean when you can't sleep at night? We're now in a position, unfortunately, where having returned from overseas, we now need to find a place for ourselves. And we're doing everything we can to try and help this couple and their daughter out. If we can find another place or win the lotto or something, we've even offered to sell them the house at below market rate or what we could get. Because, the question, I think, is how much is enough?
Mm.
And you just got to draw the line and say, look, we've got to help out our fellow human being. Otherwise, there's just no point.
Nice. Why are you feeling forced to sell now?
Well, for us to, we need to sort of keep our mortgage down as much as we can. There's no, I haven't made a fortune while living in Australia. Cost of living pressures over there were just as bad as they are here.
Mm.
In some cases, they are worse. When you have a car to register every year, one car was costing us $860 Australian. We've just come to the point where I've got to put a roof over my family's head, and we can't cover the cost of a mortgage with the new mortgage rates now and be also able to keep the rent down on this property. It's that catch-22. We could have charged more, but the outcome would have been a bad outcome for our tenants for the last 4 or 5 years. But like I say, you got to sleep at night.
Mm. And how are you feeling about that decision?
It's actually sickening us. Quite hard, actually. Because it's, you're dealing with people and their lives. And it's really taking its toll on us. But because, you get to know your tenants really well. And they've been looking after the place brilliantly. They've even, done a few little repairs themselves, there comes a point where you just got to go, we can't push it any further. We've done everything we can. Hey, if anybody out there knows somebody who can help our tenants, how great.
Yeah, well.
Shot the program a line.
Totally, and we'll definitely pass that on to you. tova@stuff.co.nz is the email to get in touch with if you have an affordable place around that part of the Wellington region, Upper Hutt or thereabouts that might be suitable for their tenants. Please do drop us a line. And Malcolm, can you tell us a bit about your personal situation as well, because people listening might be like, oh, well, you're a landlord, you must be doing pretty well, and you earn okay, but you're also down to one income, right?
Yes, now I've got two daughters. One is 3 and the other one's 18 months. One of my daughters has special needs, so we only have the one income to keep us going, and actually right now I'm living with my parents. Mm. Well, we're both in with my parents, and you can imagine that comes all of the fun. Because of that. And yes, we have some money that we got from the house in Australia, but again, it's not an exorbitant amount of cash. Whilst I'm going to have a mortgage just like the next person, having as little as mortgage that you possibly can is what you need to do. And then we've got to pay like rates, insurance, you know, I mean, like you say, mortgage repayments, car registration, repairs and maintenance, and everything else that goes with it.
Is there anything that the powers that be could have done to have made things any easier for you, the politicians, the banks, or any other kind of support out there that might have shifted your situation?
Well, it's like anything. It's like interest rates. I think Winston Churchill said it best, or his creditors are saying it best, that any nation that tries to tax itself into prosperity is about as effective as standing in a bucket and trying to lift yourself up with a handle.
So tax cuts maybe then from the government could be something that you see as a good thing coming up.
Well, yeah, it has great potential. But economics is one of those fun things. There's no simple solution. It'd be great if we could just press a button and then everything just worked, but it has rules that it has to work with.
All right. Hey, Malcolm, very, very grateful for your time today. Thank you so much for speaking with us and lending your perspective. It means a lot.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
One of the challenges facing policymakers and politicians is that every case is different. We've all got unique combinations of financial commitments. And as we're hearing, life can throw things your way that you don't expect, that you can't plan or budget for, that can change your life completely, turn it on a dime. Our next guest was doing okay, a small business owner, also a consultant, a homeowner, but then came the Auckland floods. She's now embroiled in a long-running insurance fight over storm damage to her home. Business has ground to a halt, and she needs to sell up after separating with her husband. As you'll hear, help is hard to come by. Thank you so much for getting in touch with us, and I'm sorry to hear things have been so tough for you.
Oh, right, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're a small business owner. How's business?
I am not good. Not good, really. Wholesale's not bad, but actual retail it sucks, to be honest. You know, and I don't blame people because I'm the same. I try now and buy the cheapest stuff at the supermarket rather than stuff I would actually like. So they're not going to make handmade artisan product if they don't need to, if they can get something for less than half the price at the supermarket, but it's cheap, it's not quality, and it's full of chemicals, whereas ours isn't.
And how are you then coping with that? So the difficulties with your house, the slowdown for your business, what changes are you having to make?
Well, I've gone to Wins twice. Because my doctor has signed me off fully unfit for work, although I have to still work. And I've contacted a budget advisor on the North Shore, also contacted beneficiary advocate, community law centre, an accountant, Auckland Business Commerce. Who else have I contacted?
An exhaustive list. You've got in touch with your bank as well, right? Because correct that you've switched to interest only? How was that process? Has it fixed and helped things?
Yeah, that was fine, but that was before things got really bad. And, what I'm scared of is now the housing market, it's sunk really low. At the moment, we're not going to get anywhere near as much for our home, especially if we have to sell it as is. And there's a lot riding on that. You know, my husband and I have separated. That money needs to be split, but it means there's going to be thousands that we were hopeful for. That's what we pay rates on. That probably isn't going to materialise. But I understand, the market is really nervous at the moment. People are nervous about their jobs. I understand that because I'm getting less and less work in my consultancy. It just seems to be impacting everything.
Mm.
And I know it's a contract that you go into when you're with a mortgage or a credit card or, we've got higher purchase on our van. but surely, the banks or the financial societies or financial companies know that there's a lot of people who can't pay at the moment. We just can't.
Have you been able to access any other help or support?
I have looked into insolvency or a hardship application. But after reading all the terms and conditions for all of those things, it makes such an impact on your future life.
And your credit rating and all of that. We've heard that from another guest as well.
Credit rating, you know, if you've been bankrupt, you can't be a director of a company. Well, I am director of my other company, my sole director. People might not want to employ me because they've seen I've gone through some kind of financial hardship that can be considered as an increased risk for a business to employ me. So there's all of these things, all of these connotations through no fault of, you know, my own.
And what impact is that having on your mental health, but also your health generally?
I am terrible. I'm celiac, so I have got quite a restricted diet, and gluten-free products are very expensive. So mental health, not that great. I do suffer from anxiety and depression, and I'm not sleeping. I feel like I'm a zombie, and yeah, I just think about it all the time. I can't think of anything else. I don't know where I'm going to live when I finally get out of here.
I'm really sorry to hear about your situation, and I do wish you all the best, and thank you again for speaking with us.
Oh, no problem, Tova. Thank you for speaking to me.
So those are three very different examples of people struggling to stay afloat. They're trying to do everything right. They're working hard, looking after their families, paying their bills. And there are many, many, many more countless stories like that. Financial advisor and founder of The Money Men, Josh Farry, has heard a lot of them firsthand and has plunked into the wider story. Josh, thanks very much for coming on the pod.
No worries. Great to be here, Tova.
How common are these kinds of stories, the so-called squeeze middle at tipping point?
Yeah, so I think tipping points only come under my radar in, say, the last couple of months. Before that, the last 12 months, I would say, when you're refixing people's mortgages, they find out they're spending about an extra $800 a month, and that hurts people when they're kind of like, that's an extra 10 grand I've got to find. And that was probably the average increase for clients that I've been dealing with. So yeah, it was something to suck up, and it hasn't got actually better. It's actually got a little bit worse, so it is hard for them.
And what's the answer here? How do we help these people? Because as we've heard, everyone's situations are so different. Life's throwing things at them that they didn't bargain for. People were doing okay, and they're now forced to move or sell up or make these major life changes. What can be done to help them?
I mean, from a mortgage perspective, like, that's kind of people that I deal with all the time. We try and get interest-only lending for them. The banks don't want them to have to sell their houses, and they want to keep them on the books. So the banks are always open to helping them. There's a massive range of non-bank lenders if people are in a really bad spot. And we've been using them quite a lot lately to get people out of, you know, if they defaulted a few times and they need to go to a non-bank to buy them some time and then move back to a main bank.
Are you dealing with people who are finding themselves in arrears or even getting to the point of defaulting on their mortgages?
Yeah, so, and only the last month on that, I saw some stats recently. It was something like people in financial hardship is up 32% from the last year, but there was only 12,000 people, which is horrific. But if you think about all the people with mortgages, that's 32% sounds bad, but it's not that bad.
Are you bracing for more of those types of people coming across your cases, coming across your desk with rising unemployment?
Yeah, I unfortunately am. We do investment advice and insurance advice, and you can always see that coming through from people adjusting their insurances. So yeah, I am expecting more of it over the next 6 months.
Devastating for those households. Have we got the policy settings right? Are there any levers that we should be pulling that might be making things easier for these people?
The biggest challenge is that the Reserve Bank always either undercooks it or overcooks it. And so, you know, we had the rates too low for too long. They'll be kept too high for too long. And it's hard for them to get right, but ultimately it's kind of everyone that suffers at the end of it if that doesn't go right. But I think that it's looking good towards the end of the year, you know, from an interest rate perspective. All the other metrics are looking pretty good in terms of GDP and unemployment and inflation.
So hold your nose as best you can is kind of your advice.
It really is. One of the best places we can get people money is to just look at where they're spending it. And everyone just spends and ticks stuff up. So it's just kind of holding back on that and bunkering down. There's really no other option.
All right. Hey, Josh, thank you so much for your time. Always really grateful, and news you can use as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Tova.
Next up, the politician whose job it is to find ways to help. When we bumped into Finance Minister Nicola Willis at a breakfast recently, we hit her up on the way out about any hope she can offer mortgage holders beyond the tax relief she's promising in her first budget.
Would the government ever consider offering any kind of relief, I suppose, for we're seeing defaults on mortgages go up? Is there any kind of relief that the government would consider for mortgage holders?
The best thing that we can do is manage our own spending better so that we're not adding fuel to the inflation fire which the last government let burn for far too long. That is why interest rates have climbed so high in this country, why they've been high for so long. When you look around the world, countries that managed inflation better now have lower interest rates. We now in New Zealand have the hangover from Grant Robertson's big spending ways and the money printing that went on during his time in office.
The UK has things like support for mortgage interest, and there have been calls for tax relief around mortgage payments. Is there anything that the government would ever consider?
Well, the best thing we can do is manage the economy better so that inflation is lower and interest rates can come down. That will have the biggest impact. We're also, of course, focused on delivering cost of living relief in this budget and delivering tax relief.
And the government would like to see lenders presumably making it easy for mortgage holders if they are looking to default to move to interest-only mortgages and the like?
Well, obviously we expect banks to work very positively and constructively with their customers to be making sure that they are being good citizens in that regard. We also want to see them passing on interest rate reductions when they occur. We want to see competition in the banking sector. We are very supportive of the Commerce Commission's ongoing inquiry and in fact intend to also commission a select committee inquiry into the banking sector later this year.
So grateful for your time. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you.
So are banks doing enough to help people who find themselves struggling to stay afloat financially? And is it fair that they're making so much money when mortgage holders are doing it so tough? KiwiBank Chief Executive Steve Jerkovic is with me now. Welcome to the pod, Steve. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Toby.
Are you seeing an increase in customers in financial distress?
Yeah, we are. I mean, probably if I think about the amount of time I've been involved in banking, which is a reasonable amount of time, what I'd say is that the hard times and the choices that people are having to make are sort of normalising. And what I mean by that is probably the percent of customers over the overall customer base that are having to talk to us about can they make some adjustments to their repayments is about normal. Now, if you think about that in the context of the last few years, it's quite an uptick because during COVID and extraordinarily low interest rates, people were able to, you know, get by much easier than they are today. So, yeah, it is definitely a lift. I mean, I see it a lot in hospitality and our card spend. So choices that people are making about going out for dinner, spending money on entertainment, you know, retail stores, all of those things are definitely suffering. And so, you know, our view is that the economy is cooling much quicker than most people realise and that the Reserve Bank numbers are quite lagging. And then actually by November, we should be cutting interest rates rather than later than that. So, yeah, sorry, long answer to a great question, which is, yeah, you know, people are doing it much harder than they were previously. Having said that, when I, you know, think about the few calls we did in the last quarter, 7,000 odd calls, getting down to about 80 people that need to hold off making payments. So, you know, 7,000 becomes 1,000 people that want to have a chat to us, becomes, you know, 100 people that really are doing it really tough and a couple of hundred people who think, well, maybe I'll extend my mortgage, maybe I'll go interest only. So people are exercising their options, that's for sure.
Keen to look into those numbers a bit more as well and what those options are for people. But how many of your customers are in arrears or, and even worst case scenarios, are defaulting on their mortgages?
Very few defaulting. For listeners, if you think about when most people got their mortgages on their current fixed rate, so the last 18 months or so, we were testing their ability to be able to service a high 7s or 8% mortgage rate. At the time when mortgage rates were sort of 2.5, nearly maybe 3, people were saying, geez, that seems very high compared to what we actually have to pay. But that testing's proved to be pretty accurate in quite a short time frame when you think about the extraordinarily fast uplift in interest rates. So if you're on a floating mortgage today with KiwiBank, you're at 8.5%. that's about what we tested you on. Mm. Now, probably when we were testing you, you were saying, well, you know, I could cut back on going out for dinner. Maybe I'll stop, you know, some streaming services and subscriptions and things that I've got. Well, actually, that's practically what people are doing. And so, you know, they are making big choices around that.
Do you have the number on defaults?
Yeah, so it's about 0.4 of 1%. And so that historically, that's across the whole industry. So ours is a bit lower than that. For whatever reason, historically, Kiwi Bank has had a lower number than the industry. But I guess we should look at the industry overall and say, you know, of 100 customers, you know, less than one of those is having trouble.
Mm, I mean, it's still something, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that only talks to people that are really missing payments. A lot of people will be thinking about, you know, what they have to do and what they have to compromise day in, day out, for sure. And so that number's not really, I think, the right number to think about in terms of people doing it hard.
Some of the people that we've spoken to, I mean, they've made all the sacrifices they can and they're right on the edge of that cliff. What's on offer for people in those situations? You've got interest-only repayments. What else is there and how easy is it for people to be able to access that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think across the industry, every single bank has got its eyes and ears open to how tough it is, and they're very, very keen to talk to you. So I'd always really encourage people to please lean forward into that conversation, and the sooner you have it, the better. So look, please do that. I think the thing that I would say is that a lot of customers, when interest rates were low, kept their repayments the same, and so they repaid more principal than they would have normally. And so one of the things you can do is go back to the original term. Now, doing that means that you're paying more interest over time. So, you know, there is no free kick on this thing. It is always hard choices. But quite a few customers have gone, I'll go back to what my minimum payments were rather than sticking with the more aggressive repayment. Obviously, with debt, the sooner you can pay it off, the better. But actually, people having to make some choices there. As you mentioned, some people going to interest only, so not repaying any principal at all. Which obviously, again, extends the term that you'll be paying your debt, but does give you other options. You can speak to us about a deferment in total, so you just kind of might need another couple of months to, you know, pay up. You know, we know that people have maybe got themselves in trouble with buy now, pay later, for instance, those sorts of things. So the bank can work those things through with you. We can also think about, you know, do we just have a window where you're not paying anything at all? When you're really just trying to get back on top of things.
You mentioned that 7,000 figure before. So that's 7,400 Kiwi Bank customers in that last 6 months of last year who were showing signs of financial distress. 526 of those took short-term relief. Why are so few accessing that relief? Is it because it's hard to get or?
No, I don't think it is. I think people are making choices, which is they realise that there is a financial consequence for making some of these choices. And so where they can make other choices, they're doing that first. So, you know, if you are cutting back on going out for dinner or, you know, takeaways or whatever the choices that you were making, you know, people are doing that first. A lot of people just want to know what their options are, Toga. Like it is really interesting that a lot of people ring and say, hey, I'm not in trouble now, but if I was, what would I do? What are my choices? You know, and people are really looking for cuts in interest rates. So I'm hopeful that we'll see more of those sooner to give some relief. But even 50 points compared to what you're paying before, so 0.5% compared to what you're paying before, still makes a big difference. And look, I mean, just I've got a lot of sympathy for people. You know, having interest rates go up so fast in such a short time frame is really unprecedented. Much the same way as they fell so fast was unprecedented. Mm. But you know, the V shape of that drop in interest rates and comeback has really impacted people. And, you know, we notice it a lot when people sort of get to their third and fourth installment of the higher interest rates. So the first one is like, whoa. And next one, I'm going to have to make some changes. Third one, right, okay, what are we doing here? So, you know, it does take, like all of us, a bit of time to adjust.
Talking to so many people, though, now finding themselves in the negative, though, even after doing all of those things that you've kind of outlined. What, obviously, interest rates the main driver there. What else are you? What are the other reasons that you're seeing that people find themselves in this position? And do you expect with this recent wave of job losses as well to make things worse? Rising unemployment, is it going to make it worse?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. The employment number has been so strong for so long that actually, you know, the number one thing that the overall banking industry is exposed to is a rise in unemployment, and employment has been very full. But certainly, you know, if you look across particular industries, and one obviously that you're involved in, you know, we are seeing quite big changes structurally to what's happening there. So there'll be a lot of people thinking about what's next, and the next available option may be hard to find with so many people being impacted at the same time. What's really interesting for me as well is when we speak to people about why they've got themselves into a situation where they think they should speak to the bank about their financial future. You know, historically, those numbers were, I'm getting divorced, I've got an illness, I've lost a job. Six times more likely than previous now is the cost of living. And so it's quite a marked change. You know, that's been a decade and a half where I guess I've been sort of looking at that sort of reasoning. And, you know, for a big change like that, it does really show that the cost of living crisis, as it's described, is very, very real. And, you know, six times jump is a massive jump in terms of, these are pretty, you know, long running structural things. Lose a job, you know, unfortunate illness, something else happens. Those are sort of the ones that have been persistent forever. So big differences. And I guess when you kind of look around the world as well, you know, Australia feels like it's going better. America feels like it's chugging along. We feel like a bit of an outlier, unfortunately.
It's grinding. Is there an argument, do you think, maybe for an income insurance scheme, the likes of which the previous finance minister was trying to promote? Is that something that perhaps banks would get behind?
Look, I think all options have to be thought about. And I think, you know, we don't sort of want to knee-jerk into things that, you know, change and really disrupt things for people that are getting by and doing things. But certainly those choices around what are the options, how can we help people get into a first home when they're thinking about it? Because on the flip side of it, you know, property market and prices not increasing like they have historically, perhaps creates the opportunity for people to get in. Mm. And so within all these situations, you know, one of the things about being a bank is you sort of see both sides of the coin. Depositors who really suffered in those low interest rates, with, you know, perhaps older customers who are relying on term deposits for income, did it really hard during that time period. Now borrowers are doing it much harder. So it is always a real balancing act. Unfortunately, you know, like if you put those costs somewhere, they pop up somewhere else.
And the depositors never seem to get interest rates as high as the poor old mortgage holders do. Another way of identifying financial pain is the need for overdrafts and an increase in credit card debt, both of which have increased significantly, right?
Yeah, they have, yep. And what we see is a lot more minimum payments being made on credit cards than previously. So, you know, there's always been a bunch of people who we call revolvers, which is they pay off their whole balance and essentially get interest-free money via their credit card. The number of people that can do that and clear the whole lot is dropping. And then there was always people in between, you know, the minimum payment and the full repayment. More and more people are paying off less of that. And certainly business customers' utilisation of overdrafts is starting to creep up. Mm. But actually during COVID, a lot of, you know, quite surprisingly, a lot of businesses probably got a bit of an influx of cash, but certainly seeing that run down. And so the appetite to borrow in the business market, Tova, is one of the most, you know, really, really confronting things that I've seen. My history in banking has been mainly business banking before this role in the last 5 or 6 years. And the lack of appetite to borrow, which is sort of anchored in low business confidence, is really, really staggering. To see a business lending market going backwards, which is the amount of money borrowed by businesses in New Zealand, seeing it going backwards is really, really unusual. And previously,
do you predict, you know, that just, will shift?
And perhaps I think it will. I mean, it is it's called a cycle for a reason, but, you know, to see credit growth in the business market drop from sort of mid 6% not many years ago to, you know, we're forecasting 1%, just shows how much people's appetite to invest in new capital and hire new people, all those things, has cooled really fast.
And just looking at some of those numbers, so overdrafts, KiwiBank overdrafts up 56 million on the year before, credit card debt swelled by 15 million. Thousands of your customers are showing signs of financial hardship. Some are defaulting on their mortgages. How much profit did the bank make in the last 6 months while all of this was happening?
Yeah, so for us, we made about $100 million. If you think about that in the context,
$105 million. Don't shave off the five.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, and the full year for us probably looks, you know, similarish. in terms of that number. I guess from our perspective, those returns are circa half of what the big four Australian subsidiary banks are earning. So
we get that it's all relative, right?
Yeah, it is all relative. And I think, and it does sound self-serving, so forgive me for saying this, but the only thing worse than a bank making money is a bank not making money.
Sure.
So you do need to have a stable system to make that work. But it is a really fair choice and fair question around, you know, did we look after depositors as much as we could? Well, we grew nearly as fast in deposits as we did in lending. Mm. So, you know, both sides of our balance sheet got pretty good support. We have been the only business bank, I think, that's grown over that time period, so lent money to businesses, which is an extraordinary situation given that we've got a pretty small market share in the business market. So trying to stay open for business and create confidence. But look, it's an everyday conversation when people are doing it hard. And I think the conversation with banks is always the one which is, in good times and bad, you guys seem to do pretty well.
Yeah.
And I understand that. And, you know, ultimately, that's one of the reasons we try and talk to people about KiwiBank is owned by you. You know, when it grows, you get a more valuable asset. We try and balance the right return for the right outcomes. And the whole idea of the place for the last 20 plus years has been that New Zealand's better off if it has its strong owned bank. And I think the Commerce Commission report talks about needing a bigger local player. And we're really keen to fill that spot. But we only do that when customers choose us. And so we've got to be the best bank we can.
For sure. I mean, you pulled in $307 million more on interest than in the same period the year before. That 7% half-year profit increase, $105 million after tax. I get that you're a business, and I don't think anyone would contest that being profitable is important for banks, to your point. But when people are defaulting on their mortgages, when we know there's a lack of competition in the banking sector, when you guys are just matching each other's mortgage prices rather than trying to beat them, and people are struggling because your interest rates are so high, is it morally right that you are making so much money off them at the same time?
Well, I think we are trying to be more competitive than than the marketplace. So actually, I don't think we do set that situation, given our growth in home loans, business banking and in deposits is faster than the market. I think we must be doing an okay job of getting in front of customers with the right offer.
The Commerce Commission has spoken broadly, though. This is the sector as a whole, isn't it?
It's
established patterns of price matching behaviour, reducing incentives to compete hard on interest rates.
Well, that's certainly what the report says, which is a fair comment. I think we are still giving feedback to the draft report. And look, to be fair, I think that the Commerce Commission report was probably bolder than most people expected. And I think that's a good thing because it stimulates conversation and challenge, just like you're raising. We do have to try and make a fair return for the money that's invested in us. And so we don't apologise for that. But we also want to do that in a way that helps Kiwi be better off. And so that's the balancing act that we face into all the time. But certainly understand that stakeholders like yourself and all of our customers are saying, have you got the balance right? And I think that's something we have to turn our mind to all the time.
And so it does weigh on your mind then. You do sometimes question, and perhaps this role or your role with one of the big four banks before coming over to KiwiBank, you do question, you know, are we profiting a bit too much here on people's misery?
Yeah, well, perhaps, yeah, well, for certainly for the people that are doing it tough, I take your point about the misery. And that's very fair because if you're in a situation where, you know, you're having to make really, really difficult choices and compromises, you certainly will see the fact that the bank makes money as not being the right balance. If you're in the situation where you want to borrow to expand your business, I guess you hope that we've got the capacity to help you to do that. If you want to get into your first home or you want to refinance away from someone else into it, we hope that we've got a compelling offer for that. So, you know, we need to be around and do those things. But your question is a great one, and it is one that we do turn our mind to, which is what is the right balance around sustainable returns, looking after customers, and making sure we do the right thing. I think over COVID and now, probably what I've seen, you know, one of the things you could look around and say is there is a really clear signal about mortgagee sales and the lack of them. There's a very small number for the amount of, you know, potential impairment that's around. Mm-hmm. I think that shows that the financial services industry is very conscious that we need to do the best that we can to look after people. bearing in mind that, you know, we've all got owners and they expect us to take a reasonable stance about returns.
For sure. And finally, just to that point, do you also question CEO salaries on average $2 million? You're on a mere pittance compared to some of the other guys on $1.5 million, but still three times what the Prime Minister earns. Are bank CEO salaries fair?
Well, I think there'll always be a view that actually we get paid too much, and I can understand that position. I think it is a competitive market. The shareholders look around and say, what do we need to do to try and give ourselves the best chance to achieve what we want to achieve? It's benchmarked against the market rates. You know, look, I probably don't think I'm going to do a great job of, you know, defending that situation, and I understand the scrutiny of it. But actually, we operate in a marketplace which is competitive, and, you know, those are the returns that, you know, you're looking for if you're in that role.
Steve, I'm very grateful for your candour. I feel slightly like I'm picking on you. And as you say, Kiwi Bank could be the Commerce Commission's identified. It could be the great disruptor of the big four banks as well.
Hey, look, Tover, I don't feel like that at all. I mean, honestly, from your listeners' perspective, it's really great that people are out and bold around the questions, asking harder questions like you do. Those are all really fair. Some of the answers will be satisfying for people. Others will feel like, hey, you didn't really get to the point of, you know, this balancing act, but got on you for asking the questions.
We talked for about 20 minutes. You earned about $240 over that 20 minutes by my calculation, Steve. You earned your cash today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tova.
Personally, I thoroughly enjoyed that interview, and I was grateful to Steve Jerkovich. I thought that was an honest and candid interview, and it was good to hear that those at the top earning the millions, the big bucks, are thinking of the little guys and are aware that, yeah, actually there are some pretty glaring contrasts in terms of what banks are earning and how some of their clients are struggling. I'm so interested to hear your thoughts on this and your personal stories as well, if you want to share them. Some of you might think our banks are hellhounds making far too much money while Kiwis battle. Others might think they're our biggest companies and need to do well to ensure a healthy economy. You might think both. I want to hear from all of you, tova@stuff.co.nz. And if you want to hear more on this issue, make sure you follow the pod on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, because we will be releasing a shortcast shortly, which digs into exactly what is happening with the housing market, the role of politics and political decisions like the recent changes to interest deductibility, and the role of the Reserve Bank, which of course sets the price of money, the official cash rate, which then flows on to our mortgage rates. That email again, tova@stuff.co.nz. Now for a look at the winners and losers of the week in Snakes and Leaders with Andrea Vance, National Affairs Editor for The Post and Sunday Star Times. Kia ora, Andrea, how are you going?
Hello, how are you? Feels like a bit of a quiet week.
Well, yeah, it doesn't. The Prime Minister was away, so I was expecting things to settle a bit, but then we've seen this stuff around police pay negotiations, public service cuts. There's still been quite a lot to kind of process over the course of the week, so I'm intrigued to hear who your winners and losers are. Who was the winner?
I think this week the government's offered quite a bit of relief, or quite a lot of relief, I think, to building owners in earthquake-prone buildings, and also councils as well. This is, Wayne Brown wrote about this in the Sunday Star Times last week. This has been a real issue for councillors and property owners to get their heads around these requirements that they get their buildings up to code within a certain period of time. The government's extended that deadline now and has launched, I think, that's obviously a relief, but I think the a real interesting bit there is launched a review of the building system on this seismic strengthening work. So I think it's obviously caused a lot of stress and a lot of worry for people, especially in apartments that are earthquake prone. How are they going to find the money to do this? You know, obviously it's a concern. We've seen the damage that earthquakes can do when buildings aren't adequately strengthened. But at the same time, we didn't really have a proper debate about where the cost burden falls and who can afford to do it. And we've got a whole other list of hazards that we've got to think about as well. Climate change obviously being the one that looms large. So yeah, I think it's interesting. I think if I was in one of those apartment buildings, I'd be breathing a sigh of relief this morning.
Yeah, I've heard some commentary that perhaps there was an overemphasis on the seismic strengthening at the expense of some of those other things that we should be, like managed retreat and things that we should also be taking really seriously.
Certainly.
Who was your loser of the week?
Well, yeah, I'm just really saddened to, I'm not surprised, but saddened to see the report out this week about the abuse that MPs suffer. And it's sometimes hard to summon up sympathy for MPs, but this is a really troubling issue. I mean, we need people to stand up in a democracy and represent us. You know, that's a really important job. And we have seen the real world consequences of this kind of buildup of hatred and polarization in the United Kingdom, where really sadly, in the last few years, two MPs have been murdered in their constituencies. So I just think that this is an issue that we really have to take so seriously, particularly disturbing that, you know, obviously it will come as no surprise to you and I that women suffer the most abuse, the most hatred directed at them. But I do think that it's an issue that we really need to take seriously for the sake of the health of our democracy, but also just like a decent society. I mean, I rarely engage on social media now because it's just an echo chamber of bitterness and nastiness. And what's the point? What's the point? You know, when it started, it was a lovely idea that we could all have these conversations, but that's not how it's ended up. And MPs are the ones with the power to do something about it. So I'm interested to see whether this report will galvanise them to do anything.
And we want to be able to attract good people to these jobs. Our democracy relies on that. But if MPs are scared that a fixated person could hurt or kill them or members of their family, and I think that's where things, it's particularly chilling for people as well. If they're fearful, genuinely fearful for their families, people are not going to want to do these jobs.
I mean, genuine question, would you do it, Tova? I certainly wouldn't.
I mean, I wouldn't, but not necessarily that reason. Not necessarily that reason, but just because it's a, I cannot, having been on this side of things in politics, I particularly don't get it when journalists go over, and particularly political journalists go over and become politicians. But now I've got way too many skeletons in my closet for that kind of nonsense.
also me. But okay, well, a better question is, would you recommend to anyone to do it? You know, if a young person was coming up and they wanted to be a politician, they wanted to represent people at a later stage in their life, would you recommend? I don't think I could in good conscience, especially if it was a young woman.
Yeah, I think I would, in the same way that I would recommend to a young woman to be a journalist, knowing the levels of abuse that we endure as well over the course of the job. I think if you know, you need to build up mechanisms and support networks and ways to get around that stuff. But ultimately, I so fundamentally believe in journalism and also the role of politicians in our democracy as well. So I think I would, because I believe in those institutions. So vehemently, but you know, you really do need to go in eyes wide open to some of the levels, and you shouldn't have to, you know.
Exactly. How sad is that? Anyway, so I digressed. I dragged you down an alleyway.
Andrea, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.
You too. You take care.
Looking ahead now, and the Beehive Buzz, our rundown of what to expect in the coming week. Normally, we would speak with Stuff's political editor, Luke Malpass, but like last week, we have a very special guest I'm thrilled to bring to the pod, another of my excellent colleagues in the press gallery, Glenn McConnell. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Police pay, this is something you've been leading a lot of the coverage on. How much of a stain will this be for the government? How much of a focus is it going to be in the coming days and weeks and could it be months?
Yeah, well, probably this will be such a prickly issue for the government. Remember, during the campaign, right, National Enact, they kept talking about law and order. They said they were going to be tough on crime. Well, hold on, to do that, you've got to have a big police force. They say they're going to have all these new powers for police to crack down on gangs, you know, take their patches off them, break up congregations of gang members.
Dangerous work.
Hugely dangerous work. And police are saying right now, we want to be paid more to do that. We want to be paid more generally, but we thought we'd be getting quite a bit more given the change in government. Not so.
And such an enormous disconnect, eh, between the government thinking they put this really rosy offer on the table and police just saying absolutely no way and coming out in record numbers to vote on this thing.
Yeah, and fundamentally, actually, police are right, because the base pay rise, 4%, hadn't increased since the last government. Jenny Anderson gave an offer. She is now smiling away, really. She's saying, hey, Mark Mitchell talked a big talk, but he hasn't been able to deliver yet. Now police are going to arbitration, quite an extraordinary step, something only the police force and defence force can do, pretty much, to stop them from striking. It means a third party is coming in to settle this pay dispute.
The potential for political damage is enormous for the government, because we're talking about police officers, you know, people who put their lives on the line to do this work. And then also the financial implications could be huge as well if the arbiter finds in favour of the police. Another massive story that you've been covering, Glenn, and again leading the charge on public service cuts, one of the biggest days in terms of the guillotine coming down this week, 1,000 jobs in a day.
Yeah, 1,000 jobs just between two ministries, Oranga Tamariki and the Ministry of Education. This is just a start, right? So far we've confirmed 3,000 layoffs across the public service, but we're still waiting for some huge ministries. MSD employs thousands of people, hasn't confirmed anything. Corrections hasn't said much either, the biggest ministry. So there will be many, many more layoffs across the public service. Question is, will this impact people? Will these jobs kind of going mean that we get less public service? Yet to be seen, debate on either side there. But 3,000, probably not actually that much. Remember before the election, David Seymour was saying in his perfect world, 10,000 layoffs. This is a small amount so far compared to that.
Yeah, and some good analysis actually on stuff this week as well from Susan Edmonds about how much the public service expanded by over the last 18 months too. And also some great analysis from you, Glenn. You've been keeping a tally on this too. And also that blurry line about what is a frontline worker and what is a back office worker. Are there any other big stories we should be looking out for over the coming week?
Another recess week. The Prime Minister's back in the country though, so you know, he'll normally schedule something to announce, to talk about, to show that this trip across Asia was worth it. I'm expecting though a lot more on the public service, and I'd like to find out what these dumb projects that the Prime Minister talks about are that are going to be cut, because so far it's been so murky. It's just been numbers around job losses rather than the actual projects that must stop because of this.
Yeah, dumb, a very subjective term. Glenn, it was so lovely to have you on the pod. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful week.
Thanks, Tova.
I'm always interested to hear from you too. Email tova@stuff.co.nz. And producer Chris has the honour of trawling through the mailbag and picking out some of your feedback. Chris, what have you got? Hello, Chris. Hi, how are you?
Oh, hello. I'm good, thanks. We're going to keep feedback tight this week. Do you know why?
Because it's a big old pod.
It's a big old pod, and I'm worried about falling interest rates.
Well, happily, actually, we know that we don't have falling interest rates on this pod. We know that people, even when we go way over, as I am wont to do, do tend to listen right the way to the end. So thank you to those of you who have remained with us, the vast majority of our listenership.
It's very good, isn't it? Thank you, yes. But anyway, we don't want to talk about that too much because that will defeat the purpose of keeping feedback short.
Mm-hmm. Move on, quick, chop chop.
We'll start with your interview last week with former Aussie PM Scott Morrison. That covered New Zealand's possible admission to the prestigious AUKUS alliance between Australia, the US and the UK, and whether we should revisit our nuclear-free policy. Matthew says it was a great interview and he likes the idea of us getting involved with AUKUS. The world has changed, he says, and as a small country, we need to stand with our friends globally, as we have always done. On the nuclear issue, Matthew points out that weapons and power get lumped together and wonders if we shouldn't have a more relaxed attitude to the latter. We are blessed in New Zealand, he writes, that we can generate most of our electricity for now and into the future with renewable energy. But most other countries, if they are to meet their climate change goals, will need nuclear power. Supporting nuclear power, for me, is part of being environmentally conscious. Reactor designs today are a lot safer than those built 50 years ago.
It's such an interesting debate, isn't it, around nuclear. Did we get people writing in on both sides of it?
We did indeed, and Rowan echoed the comments made by Helen Clark. She summed it up better than I could, Rowan says. We need to remain independent and nuclear free. It's who we are. This government is rapidly developing a habit of making despicable decisions with no mandate.
I do love that in our feedback inbox, we do tend to get, and it speaks wonderful things about you guys, we do tend to get people coming in on both sides of a debate. So I'm really particularly interested, again, to hear your views on the banking issue this week as well.
Last one for this week, moving on to the public sector job cuts. Ian says it would be interesting to see an article offering any evidence as to what improvement in service any of the 16,000 public sector staff added since 2017 actually provided. He says, I suspect most of the roles delivered nothing of use to taxpayers. I can't think of a single indicator, besides keeping unemployment figures artificially low, that shows an improvement in service related to the extra staff.
It's a good idea. And that's certainly Nicola Willis's argument, that we've had all of these extra staff, all of these extra public servants in education, for example, but we haven't seen those education measures tracking in the right direction. I think it's bloody hard to measure those causal links, especially when the country and the world has gone through a shock like we have with COVID during that time. But I suppose we'll see after these cuts, if any of the stats we use to measure success go backwards, or whether they improve. And then the government's argument as well around these new public sector targets, they're designed to help on that front too in terms of measurement.
Yeah, it's hard to establish the causal links, and correspondingly, it'd be interesting to see any evidence that cutting more than 3,000 jobs won't harm frontline services, as the government has promised. That might well be the case, but we just don't know.
Yeah, we watch and wait. And those, and you know, as Glenn pointed out earlier on the pod as well, so many public servants still just waiting to know whether they're going to have jobs, whether they're going to be able to pay their mortgages. Email us, tova@stuff.co.nz, with any feedback on anything we're talking about or anything in general, really. We love to hear from you. You've been listening to Tova, hosted and produced by me, Tova O'Brien. You can follow us on Apple or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, to get the latest episode automatically. And keep an eye on your feed for bonus eps, including the shortcast I mentioned earlier. You can also listen at stuff.co.nz/Tova. Thanks to audio editors extraordinaire Connor Scott and John Ropiha, senior journalist Aaron Darman, Jen Black, and executive producer Chris Reed. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. A week is a long time in politics. Anything could happen, although probably not a reduction in interest rates, at least this week. Whatever comes next, we got you. Ka kite.
If you like this podcast, please support our work. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.